Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federal Society virtual event. My name is Marco J. Lloyd, and I'm Assistant Director of Practice Groups with the Federal Society. Today, we're excited to host a Courthouse Steps oral argument on United States v. Scrimeti, featuring Aaron Hawley. Aaron serves as Senior Counsel and Vice President of the Center for Life and Regulatory Practice at the Alliance Defending Freedom. Before joining ADF, she practiced appellate law at several firms in Washington, D.C. She also worked at the Department of Justice, serving as counsel to Attorney General Michael Mukasey. Our moderator today is William Trackman. Will is a General Counsel for Mellon State Legal Foundation. Previously, he was appointed to serve in the Department of Education as Deputy Assistant Secretary in the Office for Civil Rights. He is also co-chair of the Colorado Federalist Society, member of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights' Colorado Advisory Board, and an adjunct professor at the University of Denver Sturm College of Law. If you'd like to learn more about today's speakers, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. If you have a question at any point in today's program, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window, and we'll do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, the Federal Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues, and all expressions of opinion are those of the speakers. With that, Will, thank you for joining us today. The floor is yours.
Thanks so much, Marco. Well, we're excited to have a big crowd here, and I'm honored to be talking to Aaron Hawley, a friend and former colleague who is going to give us both an educational and insightful opportunity to talk about the oral argument last week in U.S. v. Scrimeti. We also have a Q&A box, as Marco mentioned, so I can tell that this is going to be a lively crowd. So we already have a question in the queue. So if you have your questions and you want to get them in, I recommend getting them in early. We're going to talk for about 25 minutes and then maybe take up to around 30 minutes or so of questions. So with that, let's get started. Aaron, tell us a little bit about the background of the case and how we ended up here before the U.S. Supreme Court.
Sure, absolutely. First, thanks so much to the Federal Society and also my friend Will. It's a delight to be here with everyone. And so how did we get Scrimeti, the Supreme Court oral argument last week? And the case really starts in a number of different states. There are approximately half of the states in America that have chosen through their legislatures to restrict access to certain life-altering drugs and procedures, namely those that are used for gender transition procedures, puberty blockers, cross-sex hormones, surgeries, those sorts of things on minors. So Tennessee enacted one of these laws. It was pretty promptly sued by the ACLU. And it's sort of an interesting wrinkle that some of you may not be aware of. The United States intervened under a provision, it's a statutory provision that allows the United States to intervene in any federal lawsuit that involves equal protection of the laws of the Constitution. So the United States intervenes, says along with the ACLU, that Tennessee's law is unconstitutional for two reasons. First, it violates the Equal Protection Clause. Second, the United States and the ACLU contend that the transgender is a quasi-suspect class under cases like Cleburne and those sorts of cases. And so we get a district court decision. The district court sides with the plaintiffs in this case, strikes down Tennessee's law. It goes up to the Sixth Circuit, and in an opinion by Judge Sutton, rejects both of those arguments, the equal protection argument, the quasi-suspect class argument, and also floating around in there, which I should mention, the ACLU, but not the United States, had brought a parental rights claim and said that parents in Tennessee have a right to access this sort of procedure for their children, notwithstanding Tennessee's contrary law. So Judge Sutton says the parental rights claim can't go forward either. And then we have cert petitions from both the ACLU as well as the United States Department of Justice. The Solicitor General raises the protection claim, the quasi suspect class claim, but not the parental rights claim. The ACLU raises both of those claims plus parental rights. And then the Supreme Court, as we all know, since oral argument took place last week, the Supreme Court grants cert, but accepts only the United States petition. So it did not, it left off the parental rights claim. There was a bit of discussion during oral argument, but everyone was clear that that claim is not presented in this case in the current posture. But one sort of effect of that is you did have the Supreme Court grant divided oral argument to the Solicitor General as well as to the ACLU's attorney, Chief Stringio. So that sort of gets us up to argument day.
Yeah. And so let's jump right in then to the argument. Long argument. In fact, I was surprised at how much of the time period was taken up by the Solicitor General and Chase Strangio. It seemed like a long block of time. What were your initial takes on the oral argument, you know, as it went, not necessarily the prediction on how the case is going to turn out, but what observations do you have about oral argument just generally?
Sure. So I would encourage anyone that has to listen to this. This is one that is worth listening to. The oral advocates were excellent. Of course, Elizabeth Brelegar is a really accomplished, very articulate oral advocate. She argued for the United States. Chase Strangio did a nice job with oral argument. And then you had Matt Rice, which did a fantastic job. Again, his first oral argument in a case of, you know, no significance at all, but did great under the pressure. And really a fantastic opportunity as you listen to the oral argument to see the different personalities of the justices come through. You see, you can learn a lot just about their sort of way they view federalism, the way they view the sorts of equal protection clause, constitutional challenges, the relationship between state legislatures and the court itself. And you get a lot of that in this oral argument. So would encourage everyone to listen. I thought the advocates were really phenomenal, each for advocating for the side they were for.
Talk through some of the questions that the justices asked, because this was a pretty hot bench, I would say. I listened to the argument, and it seemed like the justices themselves were kind of arguing back and forth, but then also probing the advocates relatively closely. Did you notice any particular questions that you thought were insightful or that you thought might indicate some way that the justices are considering how to rule in the case?
Sure. Well, one thing to note at the outset is I think there had been a blog post or two noting that, you know, we would all be watching Justice Gorsuch, because one of the United States' chief theories is that the court should interpret the Equal Protection Clause to include the same sort of but-for causation analysis as was applied in Bostock. So as everyone was watching Justice Gorsuch, no secret or surprise, but Justice Gorsuch didn't say a word during oral argument. So he didn't lay any of his cards on the table. So we're left to guess at how he thinks his analysis in Bostock applies to the Constitution. Justice Alito took that sort of argument head on and said, you know, one of your arguments, he addressed it to the SG and said, one of your arguments here is that we should apply the but-for reasoning of Bostock. But why would we do that? This is a constitutional provision, not a statutory provision. It involves different words, a different sort of soil that comes with the equal protection challenge than would a statutory enactment. So Justice Alito at least took that apple by the horns, but we didn't hear from Justice Gorsuch. Justice Alito was also really attuned to the scientific uncertainty. He really pressed, as you said, the Solicitor General on some of the United States statements regarding the state of the science. I think the United States had said something like, you know, these procedures and drugs are beneficial. And he said, you know, do you still stand by that? If we look at things that have happened since, we have the Cass report, we have England banning procedures for those under 16, except in research settings. So really sort of pressing her on the state of the science and where there, it can really be said that these drugs and procedures are beneficial as a class. So he was really, really tuned on the science. We had, I think, insightful questions from both the Chief Justice as well as Justice Kavanaugh. And both of those justices, no surprise, but were concerned about the relationship between the federal courts and state legislatures. As I mentioned, about half of the states have passed legislation that limits these sorts of drugs and procedures to minors. And both the chief and Justice Kavanaugh were really making the case that there's at least scientific uncertainty. You've got to grant us that. And if that's the truth, why do we want federal courts to step into an area? Sort of remnants of Dobbs, Justice Kavanaugh even said, the Constitution doesn't say anything on this. Why do you want us nine people to decide this question? So it's a little bit of a flashback to Dobbs in that respect, but really clear that Justice Kavanaugh and the Chief Justice were concerned about federal courts stepping into this, what they saw as sort of a medical landmine filled with uncertain science, and wanted to leave that to the elected branches. Justice Barrett's questions, I think, were some of the most interesting. She really went to the government's second theory and was asking all of the attorneys from each side, what do we do with this idea of transgender as a quasi-suspect class? And does it fit within the traditional analysis or not? So that she was sort of keying on that. Justice Kagan's questions, she had a broad ranging questions, but she was also concerned with, what happens to this on remand? What is the precise standard of review? Can we send it back? For my part, I should also mention Justice Jackson. And for those of you who listen to the argument, Justice Jackson was particularly concerned about what she saw as parallels between the Loving case and interracial marriage and state's bars on that and this case. The state's response to that was we're not classifying at all. The Virginia statute in Loving clearly did so. Here, the position of the state of Tennessee was that Tennessee's law didn't take any position regarding a sex-based classification, but rather simply prohibited certain procedures based on their purpose. So a really active bench.
One thing that struck me out of the gate was, I'll call it modesty, the modesty of the Solicitor General's position, which seemed to say, you don't have to worry about the science. You don't have to think really hard about anything. All you have to do is declare that this is about sex and send it back to the appellate court. And their argument, I think, was based on your description of the Tennessee law. And I think the hypo that really summed this up was, if a patient, a minor patient, comes to a doctor and says, I want hormones in order to deepen my voice, the doctor's allowed to do that if it's a male and disallowed if it's a female. So that just is obviously a sex classification. And that really sounds like Bostock to me. So I was number one, also struck by Justice Gorsuch's silence, and number two, confused as to why the Solicitor General and Chase Strange were resistant to the Bostock analogy. But what's your response generally to maybe that analogy, and then maybe also the idea that Bostock has nothing to say here? That surprised me that they're resistant to that analogy.
Sure, absolutely. I think at the outset, one second, sorry. Mm-hmm. I've got sick kids as always. Yeah. But the So I think at the outset, this idea, the Tennessee would certainly respond to the idea that it depends on or sex is a but-for cause, to say that that's absolutely incorrect, that boys and girls are on both sides of the line. And there was a really interesting colloquy between Matt Rice, Tennessee Solicitor General, and I believe it was Justice Kagan, could have been Justice Sotomayor, but really pressing on this question of, can you get this just to deepen your voice? And his response was, absolutely not. You have to have a medical purpose in order to get these drugs that can have very serious consequences and serious side effects. And so Tennessee's position is that girls can get these sorts of hormones. Girls can get estrogen for precocious puberty. They can't get it to gender transition. Same thing for boys. Boys can have testosterone for precocious puberty, or should they, puberty blockers for precocious puberty, but they can't have a puberty blocker because they want to look more like a girl. And so Tennessee's point was that boys and girls are on both sides of this line. It's not a sex-based classification at all, but grounded in medical purpose. And as you said, the Solicitor General's argument, I thought, was shockingly narrow. I think, you know, definitely have to grant that she perhaps read the room. In that sense, her oral argument, at least in my opinion, was very different from her briefs. Her briefs relied heavily on Bostock and had broader arguments. She said at least five or six times, like, all you have to do here is say it's a sex-based classification, and it's in the back. She admitted a number of times that there may be really legitimate reasons that states may want to limit these sorts of drugs. And then maybe the law would even upstand intermediate scrutiny once you send it back to the Sixth Circuit. But she seemed really to want to sort of preserve the argument that maybe this could be struck down under intermediate scrutiny some other day, but not today. So absolutely correct. I agree with you, Will, that her argument was particularly narrow, especially when you read her briefs and her reliance on Bostock.
And I saw some commentary about Justice Gorsuch that had to be an intentional choice to be silent. I'll offer your hot take about Justice Gorsuch's silence.
Sure. So in my experience, Justice Gorsuch is usually not shy to ask opinions or questions when he's interested in the subject matter of a case. So I would think that I don't think he's uninterested in this subject matter. So I think it has to be true that his not asking questions was intentional for whatever personal reason. If he didn't want to, you know, lay his cards on the table, if he wanted to hear what the justices and other advocates had to say. But certainly I think we can all acknowledge that Justice Gorsuch is interested in this topic. And so we must await his views probably until June.
No, in terms of what's before the court, there's obviously the whether there's a sex classification, and then I suppose this issue about whether transgender status has a suspect classification for heightened scrutiny. And maybe the science is all of this in front of the court, or as the Solicitor General wanted to narrow it, is there an argument that really the science and the question of whether this is a valuable treatment is not even before the court at all? What would Tennessee say in terms of what is the court is deciding here?
I think Tennessee would say all of those things are before the court. And with respect to the science, you're correct. The SG sort of wanted to wave all that away and say, you know, the district court should get to decide that. But both the Chief Justice and Justice Kavanaugh pointed out that the record at a minimum reflects, and here's one place in which I think amicus briefs can really make a difference. Amicus briefs could alert the court to subsequent developments like the CAST report, which found that these procedures are just generally more risky. They have more risks than benefits. For example, one of the, I think, talking points that's often made on behalf of providing these sorts of treatments to minors is that it prevents the risk of suicide. The CAST report, as Justice Alito noted, just said that's not true, that the evidence doesn't back that up. So these are really significant facts. I think in the Solicitor General's view, that the right thing to do was to kick it back to the district court, say this was a sex classification, and let the district court set that out. I think if you listen to Matt Rice or maybe to the Chief Justice and Justice Kavanaugh, their intuition was, wait a minute, this is a mess. This is scientific uncertainty. We've got a lot of evidence on the state side. Why don't we let the legislatures decide this, especially when, as Justice Kavanaugh said, the Constitution doesn't take a side on this issue.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned amicus briefs. I noticed that Justice Kavanaugh, and I think maybe Justice Barrett as well, asked this question that was stemming from, maybe it was the Independent Women's Forum brief about women's sports and how the decision here could affect myriad other contexts in which transgender individuals say, you have to treat me as the sex that I claim. What did you make of those sorts of questions? Were there any other amicus briefs that you thought played a role in the oral argument? And how do you think that shakes out in terms of a decision?
Sure. So I know a number of amicus briefs did focus on the science. And we saw that come up in the oral argument. They talked about Sweden and Finland and other countries that have sort of walked back treating minors with these sorts of drugs and surgeries. In addition, when the question about the women's sports, I think is really important because the claims being made here are under the Equal Protection Clause. So the Solicitor General admitted that the same analysis that she, in her view, intermediate scrutiny would apply to the inclusion of biological men in women's sports, just as her view is that intermediate scrutiny should apply to Tennessee's law. But she was really careful to say, but the factors might be different. And again, she actually said that, you know, maybe this law will be upheld, Tennessee's law, on review. And she pointed to West Virginia's law that has imposed various restrictions on minors obtaining these drugs or devices, but has sort of an exceptional out. If you have two physicians, if you have the consent of the parents, if you have all of these sorts of findings, then you're able to get the drugs in West Virginia. And the Solicitor General seemed to be saying, you know, look over there, look at West Virginia, you know, maybe that's a better way to go. But at least say this is sex-based and send it back so we can live to fight another day.
Yeah, so it is interesting that analogy to the West Virginia law struck me as interesting that she actually, I think Elizabeth Perlegar actually said that would survive likely heightened scrutiny, which I was surprised to even hear her offer that take.
She did, yeah. Justice Alito got a couple of concessions, and then that was one of them.
So, I mean, it's always hard to make predictions based on oral argument. Talk to me about how you're feeling, what sense you have from the justice's questions, and then if you want to offer a prediction on what, you know, an opinion might look like or what a decision might look like, I want to, you know, give you the opportunity to give us your tea leaf reading.
Sure. Well, it's always, as she said, really hazardous to try to read the Supreme Court tea leaves. That never ends well. But I'm going to still align from Paul Clement, who I had the privilege of working for. And he says sometimes after oral argument, I'd rather be on Tennessee's side in this case than on the other side. You know, not spiking the football. There were a lot of questions and a hot bench and lots of concerns. But generally speaking, I think Tennessee probably came out of the argument feeling pretty good, at least better than the other side. And in terms of what the opinion might look like, that of course is really reading the tea leaves. It seemed like there was a push from Justice Kagan, maybe Justice Sotomayor, to narrow it and say, let's just send it back. Let's let the district court deal with all the science. We can say on its face that this is a sex classification, and then just send it back. So sort of a narrow, not much to see here opinion. Maybe Tennessee's law will survive, maybe it won't. Again, I'd mentioned Justice Kavanaugh, the Chief Justice, seemed really concerned about federal courts intruding into the traditional area of states regulating medical procedures. We're not sure where Justice Gorsuch falls. Justice Barrett really keyed on sort of the Arlington Heights analysis. Is there intentional discrimination here? Is transgender a quasi-suspect class? Justice Kagan, interestingly, sort of made the same question. She said, you know, there's boys and girls on both sides of this line. So doesn't that sort of obviate that this government's position that this is a sex-based classification? Don't we really need to talk about transgender status? I think she's right that there are boys and girls on both sides of the line. So it's not a sex-based distinction. The Supreme Court in Dobbs and Godoliga makes that point. But I don't think you're going to find a majority on the court to find that transgender is a quasi-suspect class. You had questions about political power and immutability and then de jure segregation and those sorts of things. But it didn't seem like there were enough justices leaning that direction. So I think we have to wait and see. But I suspect that the court will be hesitant about intruding onto this sort of area of state medical regulation.
Yeah, just to be candid, I mean, I saw a lot of commentary saying this is a win for Tennessee, and I thought it was much more like a coin flip. Obviously very hazardous to start making guesses. But we do have quite a few questions building up, so I'm going to turn to those. And if you have a question, go ahead and drop it in the Q&A box. We are going to go about half an hour with questions. The first one I'm going to read is from John Scheller. Interesting question about what happens after January 20th when President Trump takes office. Presumably there will be a new attorney general and a new solicitor general. What opportunity is there for the United States to switch sides or suppose withdraw the petition for certiorari? Is there anything that happens after January 20th that's related to this case specifically?
Absolutely, and great question. So this happens not infrequently as administrations change. When President Biden took office, there were a number of cases in which the United States changed positions and basically files a short letter with the clerk saying, you know, based on our renewed consideration of these issues, we're taking a different position. So I would not be surprised if the Trump administration files that sort of letter brief with the clerk. But I don't think the case can go away. And the reason the case can't go away is there's a Supreme Court rule that provides that the parties below are parties at the Supreme Court. So even though the Supreme Court did not take the ACLU's petition, the ACLU is part of the case before the Supreme Court, and there will still be adversity. So I don't think the court gets a pass on this one, even if the Trump administration changes its mind and switches positions.
Next question is from Eric Mounts, once again about Gorsuch's silence, and I'll just add a little flavor to the question. Gorsuch was silent, does that mean he thinks Bostock applies and he's a lock for the people who would review for heightened scrutiny because it's necessarily a sex-based classification?
I don't think so at all. And the reason being is Justice Alito pointed out that Bostock was a statutory decision based on Title VII, was enacted in the 1960s. And it would be very strange to take a statutory provision and the reasoning for that statutory provision in the 1960s and apply it to a constitutional provision that was enacted in the 1800s and that uses different language. So I think that's one reason we saw the Solicitor General sort of backing away from the Bostock argument. Is this just tough to say that we should use that analysis for purposes of the Equal Protection Clause? Another thing that those of you who have read Bostock closely will remember was that Justice Gorsuch himself carved out sort of intimate spaces as well as women's sports and said, you know, we're not talking about those. We're talking about hiring and firing in the context of Title VII. The equal protection analysis, as the other side conceded, goes much broader. If the court says that intermediate scrutiny applies here, it also applies to women's sports. It also applies to sex segregated bathrooms. And I would think at least that would give something that would be something that Justice Gorsuch would have to think again about. It's not directly controlled by Bostock.
The next question is from Christopher Green. It's about Justice Barrett's questions related to Arlington Heights. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about what she was getting at with those questions? And whether they would factor into something that the Solicitor General wasn't asking the court to rule on. Because I think General Preligar said that's not what we're here to talk about, but Justice Barrett seemed interested in this Arlington Heights analysis. What did you make of that?
Yeah, so in rereading the transcript, I had a little bit of a different impression than from oral argument on Justice Barrett's questions. And when she asks the question, her very first question, she says, I want to pick up on one of Justice Kavanaugh's earlier questions. And he pointed out that the burdens of the law fall equally on boys and girls because under Tennessee's law, neither can transition. And then she says, you know, can you respond? She's asking this question of the Solicitor General. Can you respond that it's kind of the sex classification is one that will conform to biological or gender assigned at birth? And then why isn't that more of an Arlington Heights argument? So I had missed that first sort of coming in question where she's saying, like, isn't Justice Kavanaugh right that this is not a sex-based classification because there are boys and girls on each side of the line? And so from that position, then if that is her viewpoint, then all you're left with in this present case is the question of whether transgender status is a suspect class or a quasi-suspect class. And so then her arguments go on to talk about Arlington Heights and how you can perhaps show intentional discrimination from a wide variety of factors. And I think the Solicitor General from Tennessee, Matt Rice, did a good job of pointing out sort of the problems inherent in that multi-factor test. It looks at the legislative history, it looks at the motivations of the legislators, it looks at the context. It's really been sort of a discredited form of constitutional interpretation, piling suspect classes on tiers of scrutiny and those sorts of things. So something that one wouldn't typically think of Justice Barrett as being the sort of jurist that does those sorts of things. So I thought in rereading those questions again, that they might all be from the context of this isn't a sex-based classification. What else is left? And trying to get at those arguments.
On the point about, boys and girls being on both sides of the line, I thought Justice Jackson's analogy to the Loving case about interracial marriage was interesting. I saw some commentary that was kind of poking fun at her to, make an equivalence between this issue and the obviously very offensive nature of anti-miscegenation laws. But what she's saying is just because there are people who are equally disadvantaged doesn't take it out of the realm of a classification. Did you get the same impression? And did you think that the Solicitor General of Tennessee had a good response to those questions?
Yeah, so I thought the Solicitor General of Tennessee did have a good response. And of course, Justice Jackson, not only are those sorts of laws abhorrent, but they're personally important to her. So I think she was coming at this with a lot of feeling, and she's had a lot of concern. But I think Matt Rice, the Solicitor General, had a good point that in this sort of statute that Tennessee has enacted, you really don't have any sort of classification at all. The Virginia law in Loving did classify wrongly based on race. Here, what Tennessee is doing is saying that you can't have these drugs and devices, puberty blockers, cross-sex hormones, or surgeries for a particular thing. And again, you can't get them just because you want them. If you want that, they're not cosmetic. As the Solicitor General said, you have to have a medical purpose. And when that medical purpose is to change a gender characteristic or feature, then that's something you have to wait until you're 18 to make the decision to do.
Yeah. Next question is from Clark Forsyth. I'll just read this. What is the prospect that the majority will issue a decision that applies Dobbs and or Ferguson v. Scrupa, which I'm not totally familiar with, to hold that drugs, devices, surgeries at issuance committee are encompassed within the state's police power and uphold the Tennessee law? So maybe a question about whether Dobbs changes the nature of the case or whether the state's general authority over medical procedures is really going to drive the decision here.
So I don't think so, because when you look at the majority opinion written by Justice Alito and Dobbs, what he says is that the states have a legitimate interest in policing the medical profession, in protecting unborn life, in protecting women's health, and in all of those sorts of things, including policing the medical profession. But he calls that a legitimate interest, and the reason that legitimate interest triumphs in Dobbs is because the Constitution is silent on the question of abortion. It nowhere contains a right to an abortion. So in that sense, it really is just saying that these medical decisions that have historically been made at the states are legitimate. So I don't think it really ratchets that up in a way that would be controlling here.
Anonymous question. So if the court only took the United States' claim, and we can probably assume the new administration will take a different view on these issues, would this case now become moot? I think you addressed that this case won't go away necessarily. I am interested a little bit in the ACLU raising the parental rights argument, because that's an argument that I see fairly frequently coming from the liberty movement, which is that parents have a right maybe to be a part of their kids' curriculum or to be involved in a social transition of gender identities. Offer some commentary about that argument, why it's not before the court, and whether we might have some sort of, cross-partisan consensus on parental rights.
Sure. So just a point on the mootness question. That's slightly different about a question is whether if the Trump administration changed policies, then there would be an argument that the current case is moot. You would still have adversity, though, and you'd still have the Tennessee law. So I don't think that mootness would probably prevail in that instance. But the mootness is certainly something that could be raised. With respect to the parental rights, really interesting. And as you said, you see parental rights rights claims, in a wide variety of situations. You see parental rights claims raised on behalf of parents whose children are in school, districts that have secret transition policies, and the parents want to be advised if their child decides to go by another name and are saying that it violates their due process right as parents to not have access to that information. So you see those sorts of things. I think what makes this different here is that what the parental rights claim at issue in Scrimeti is that parents have a right to an illegal in Tennessee medical procedure or drug. And as the D.C. Circuit and other courts have held, that there is no right for anyone, parents included, to get access to a drug that's not legal in a particular jurisdiction. Parents do have the right from various Supreme Court cases to refuse within limits medical treatment and to say, I don't want my child to get a sort of vaccine. Again, that has limits. You can't say that I don't want my child to have life-saving care, but you can say, I don't want my child to have this vaccination based on my religious beliefs or those sorts of things. But it's very different to say, I want access to a drug no one else can have because it's illegal.
Yeah. Our next question is from Mitchell Kiner. The Chief Justice also joined the Bostock opinion, but he seemed to see the two cases as different, according to the commenter. Should we infer that Gorsuch also recognizes the difference? Why don't I open that up to both Chief Justice and Justice Gorsuch, since they are both in the majority in Bostock? What can you read from the Chief Justice's questions, and do you agree that the Chief Justice sees them as different cases?
I think that's absolutely correct. The Chief Justice's questions, and he asked a number of them, were, I think, all certainly primarily aimed at this idea that in an area of medical uncertainty where the Constitution isn't pretty clear, do we really want, I think he said nine people, Justice Scalia said, nine unelected judges making these determinations for the country? Do we want, nine justices determining these policy arguments based on incomplete and contradictory science? Or do we want state legislators in the first instance to make those determinations? So I think that does suggest that he sees this case as very different from Bostock. And I don't have any tea leaves to read for Justice Gorsuch, but I would remind our listeners that Justice Gorsuch did carve out things like bathrooms, things like dorm rooms, things like sports, and under the equal protection analysis, those things would be very suspect. So I think that it is not a bygone conclusion at all that Justice Gorsuch would find Tennessee's law invalid. Mm.
Another anonymous question about West Virginia. So the West Virginia law about transitioning came up, but there's actually a pending cert petition about West Virginia's sports law, which requires competitors to play consistent with their biological sex. Did you find that interesting that the Solicitor General would cite West Virginia favorably in one context while possibly opposing the position of West Virginia in this other law about transgender issues?
That's a really fantastic point that I wish one of the justices would have asked about, because again, I think the Solicitor General's response would have probably been, well, under the intermediate scrutiny analysis, you have different interests, different sports interests, different interests in women being able to play and compete, and those are different than in the transgender space. But the commentator is absolutely correct that both of those cases involve the equal protection challenge in addition to Title IX in the BPJ case that's being referred to, but absolutely that I think the Solicitor General was really pushing the West Virginia law, and as you mentioned, Will, even Justice Alito got her to concede that law would be constitutional, but meanwhile she's saying that the women's, I think it's the Sports Fairness Act in West Virginia is unconstitutional. So it's a really good point.
Next question, again anonymous. Could the court overturn Bostock as part of its decision in this case, if it wanted to hold and overturn or modify or maybe confine to its facts? Is there a way that it could limit Bostock by saying, you know, that was a Title VII case? We are confronted with a very unique circumstance and Bostock is limited to its facts or something like that. Is there a way that the court could cut back meaningfully on the Bostock decision?
So I think it's, Bostock's obviously about Title VII statute enacted, I think it's in 1964. Here we have the Equal Protection Clause enacted in 1868. So there are a lot of reasons to say they're very, very different. But I do think it's true that what the court says about the Equal Protection Clause in this context might shed some light about what it thinks about Title VII related to Title IX for the sports context. So if we get some language saying, Title VII was unique, it's about hiring and firing. It's not about education. It's not about women's sports. Then I think that would signal that perhaps the Title IX rules are suspect and that the court would view Title IX differently than Title VII. So we could get some hints or indications. I don't know how likely that is. One sort of interesting part of the oral argument, Justice Kavanaugh is pushing back on this idea that the court can just send it back to the lower courts and says, well, then, you'll be up here again in a year. So there is a sense, I think, in which the court's not super crazy about these issues, querying why they took cert in this case at all, they didn't need to. But if that is a major motivating factor, then perhaps we'll see something that impacts the Title IX cases.
Yeah. Our next question is from Eric Broninger. How can there be discrimination on the basis of sex if the sex of the individual is that which is in question? What is the Tennessee government discriminating against exactly? I mean, I'm happy to have you answer that question. Maybe a little bit of flavor is, it's interesting to hear them talk so much about sex and maybe even the immutability of sex in order to get into this world of suspect class, when we're talking about people who also claim that gender is fluid and you can be two-spirited and that these things are intrinsic to your nature that have nothing to do with your sex. So it's interesting to hear, on the one hand, them talk so boastfully about sex and how important and how clearly this is a classification, at the same time that people are talking about the fluidity of gender.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And it really comes into play legally when you're talking about, whether transgender status is a quasi or a suspect class. And there were some questions related to this and about whether that sort of status is immutable. And several justices, Justice Kavanaugh, Justice Alito, really, pushed on the question that we know that there are detransitioners. We know there are folks who regret these sorts of procedures and drugs, especially taking them in their youth, and they later change their mind and align their bodies to the extent they can at that point with their biological sex. And so doesn't that mean, that was the import of the question, that this gender is not immutable, which goes right to your point, Will, that we're told gender is fluid. And with respect, I think to sort of think about how the SG was thinking about this case, she was really pushing the idea that, you can get estrogen if you have sort of maybe delayed onset puberty. If you're a girl with delayed onset puberty, you can get estrogen. If you're a boy, you can't. But that really elides, as Tennessee argued, the purpose of that. You don't just get drugs because you want them. There has to be a medical purpose. And when the medical purpose is to start puberty and have sort of a natural progression of what estrogen does to a girl's body, estrogen does something very different to a biological male's body and can create all sorts of risks and adverse reactions. And so the Solicitor General of Tennessee really pushed back on this idea that these are the same medical treatments. They have different purposes. They also have different effects on bodies that are biologically male as well as biologically female.
Yeah, I mean, so the questioner doesn't raise this hypothetical, but it's one that I thought of, and I won't ask you to weigh in if you don't want to. But if Tennessee discovered that there's some sort of transracial surgery, that someone wants to change their race, and it's never effective, always painful, always results in side effects, and so they banned it, would that have to satisfy strict scrutiny because it incidentally involves skin color, when really what the law is targeting is the fact that the operation itself is medically problematic and has side effects and dangerous? Like, the classification is what's good and what's bad, and the state has a a role in playing to make sure that medical treatment is adequate. Anonymous attendee, why did the court only take the SG's petition? What is the risk, if any, of the individual plaintiff's due process argument coming back at a later stage? I guess that would be the parental rights argument.
Sure. So my guess, and I think it's just a guess, is that they want to let these sort of parental rights arguments percolate a little more. We are seeing them from sort of different ideological camps. You know, the sort of traditional view that parents have the right to direct the education and upbringing of their children from Troxell, as well as the school choice cases, homeschooling cases, and this idea that parents, you know, rights don't stop at the schoolhouse door. You have a right to know about the curriculum. You have a right to know if your child is currently being transitioned by school staff. And then on the other hand, you have the ACLU saying, well, we have a parental substantive due process right to give our child this medication, even though, or surgery, even though it's illegal under Tennessee law. So my sense is that the court really wants to let this percolate. The court hasn't had a case on this since 2000 with Troxell versus Granville. One of the interesting things is that the Justice Thomas is the only justice who was on the court for that decision. Mm-hmm. So what the court really thinks about parental rights and how it sort of the permutations, whether it's the privilege and immunity, whether it's a substantive due process right, whether it's a procedural due process right, I think is something the court hasn't, these justices haven't spoken much on. So my guess is they want it to percolate more, but that's just a guess.
Another anonymous question. Notably, the Biden administration has shopped Bostock around among its various agencies, including in Title IX, as you pointed out a minute ago, by issuing a notice of interpretation saying, if we put Title IX with Bostock, we mix them in a blender, all of a sudden schools can't discriminate based on homosexuality or transgender identity, or really any sexual orientation. They don't stop there. This is any sexual orientation, any gender identity, including what I would assume are gender fluidity identities. And then I think also HUD has imported Bostock into housing discrimination. And I think that also applies maybe even to college dormitories that have religious exemptions under Title IX that they have to treat gender identity as dispositive. Will the decision in Scrimeti affect those other places where the Biden administration has shopped around the Bostock decision?
So I think this is one place where we can definitely say elections have consequences. And so hopefully what will most nearly and closely affect those sorts of things is a change in administration. But I do think, similar to the Title IX question, the equal protection analysis is distinct and different. And so the court would not have to say anything, I don't think, that would change those sort of interpretations that Bostock put forth by the various agencies. That said, to the extent the court clarifies that Bostock was you know, sort of sui generis to Title VII, was about hiring and firing, where these sorts of classifications don't make any difference, then it could be, you could take that language and apply it to these other statutory analyses and interpretations by the Biden administration. I don't think directly. Again, you have a constitution on one hand and these various statutes on the other, but we could get some sort of argument material from the decision.
Well, if you have a question, this is your last chance. We have a few more before we close. The next one is also anonymous. Can you comment on the immutability debate? Why is that an important focus, and why was Justice Alito asking questions about whether transgender status is or is not immutable?
Sure. So the court has this sort of multifactored analysis that it looks like to determine whether a particular status, one example is people with disabilities. The Supreme Court has been asked to find that folks with disabilities are a suspect class. It has declined to do so. And when the court is confronted with these sorts of questions, it goes through a series of factors. Does the group in question, do they have very little political power? Are they sort of politically powerless is one thing the court looks at. Have they been subject, this goes to sort of Justice Barrett's questions, to de jure segregation or discrimination under the law? And then a third factor that the court has said is that classification can't be a suspect classification unless it's immutable and you can't change it. So things like race and biological sex, you can't change. And Justice Alito and Justice Kavanaugh as well were sort of probing on the question that we know at least some people come to regret transition decisions and to go back to their biological sex. So doesn't that show that it's not immutable? So that's sort of the legal relevance and how that question came up with the transgender, is it a suspect class question.
That was a deadly question, I thought, for Chase Strangio. And I think the answer that the Chase Strangio was trying to get out was, well, maybe that person was never really transgender, and the transgender status is immutable in the sense that you are always going to be struggling with your gender identity. And maybe you flip back and forth, but it's a binary. Yes, you are transgender, or no, you are cisgender. And I think that's the most charitable reading of what that was happening. But I thought Justice Alito really held the feet to the fire there.
I agree with that. And I think it's hard to make the argument based on, you know, we know that there are, you know, you can debate the number of people, but we know that there are people who regret this decision and want to live a life consistent with their biological sex. And that, I think that is pretty devastating to the immutability argument.
Yeah. Next question is about the COVID-19 debate. During the oral argument from John Scheller. So Chase Strangio made these arguments about how the COVID-19 science was really complicated, and yet the court entered a bunch of decisions about how states were bound by the free exercise clause and maybe invalidated things like OSHA vaccine mandates. So it's not foreign for the court to get in the middle of a heated scientific debate. What was your read on those sorts of questions and how that exchange played out?
Yeah, so it seemed to cause a bit of confusion. My impression was maybe that wasn't something that had come up in a moot. And Chase was asked the question, you know, are there other cases like this? And Chase responded that, well, maybe the COVID cases. And I think most of those cases involved governments treating certain types of organizations like churches worse than other types of organizations like, you know, casinos. And the court said you can't treat a church worse than a casino. If you have concerns about people gathering in a church, surely you also have concerns about people pulling slot machines all together. And so I think, the point is true that, you know, the Constitution applies even in emergency situations. But I think that the two are really quite distinct, and I'm not sure that that the COVID examples really, really did a lot for the ACLU's position here.
Yeah. One anonymous question teeing up on the immutability issue. What do we do with religion, since religion, I guess, technically isn't immutable? Obviously, most people don't have religious fluidity, but theoretically, I suppose you can always change your religion. And I think people generally consider religious discrimination to be on par with other forms of heightened scrutiny type discrimination.
Yes. And so that's an interesting question. Of course, the First Amendment, you know, is most frequently employed, and that is a separate amendment apart from the Equal Protection Clause that requires governments to not infringe or abridge the free exercise of religion. So I think most of the religious cases fit under that sort of bucket, where you're not really talking about immutability, you're talking about whether the government is infringing or abridging free exercise rights. So I think that's a reason you don't think about, you know, is religion immutable? It's because of the First Amendment.
All right, well, we'll give the last question to Roman Gallis, who asks about concurrences, which is an interesting question. Do you think Justice Gorsuch will write a concurrence, possibly about Bostock? And are there any other concurrences that you could see coming from the bench in here, wanting to talk about something that maybe wouldn't get 5 votes, but that is a pet project? I could see, for instance, Justice Kavanaugh writing about women's sports. He's obviously known as Coach Kavanaugh, yeah, and cares deeply about that issue. What sorts of concurrences could you imagine coming out of the court?
Yes, that's a great question. As you know, Will, concurrences have sort of exploded as of late. Maybe one of the things that's sort of a byproduct of the court having fewer cases for whatever reason is that the justices are more likely to write concurrences, especially on issues that they feel deeply about. So I would suspect we would have several concurrences. I think we'll probably have more than one dissent. And you know, what those theories will be, I think, is anyone's guess. I think your thought about Justice Kavanaugh and sports is a good one. You could see, you know, a dissent, suggesting the transgender status really should be a quasi-suspect class. So I think we could see a whole panoply of decisions coming out of this single case.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Erin. This has been just an incredibly insightful hour. And thank you to all the commenters and questioners who have submitted. I feel much more educated about what happened in oral argument, and definitely feeling like whatever happens, we will have talked about it and we will have at least addressed the possibility. Marco, with that, I'll turn it over to you to close us out.
Well, thank you both for that fantastic discussion and the benefit of your time and expertise today. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I'd also like to thank you, our audience, for joining us. We greatly appreciate your participation. For information on more upcoming events, please visit our website or all major social media platforms at FedSoc. On that note, we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.